welcome to the GVA Legal Podcast. My name is Jean Kambuni and I am your host. Last year in November, the 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, or Conference of the Parties of the UNFCCC, more commonly referred to as COP27, happened in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Climate change is the issue of our time. And so in studio with me today is Dr. Vincent Oyeba. He's a principal research scientist and the national coordinator of the Climate Change Research Program at the Kenya Forestry Research Institute.
Thank you very much, Jane, for the opportunity to be here.
And also with me in studio is my co-host, and she is Estella Ojango, a practitioner in environmental law and a partner in the employment and pensions practice area here at Gikera and Badgama Advocates. Welcome, Stella.
Thank you, Jean. Glad to be here this morning.
Now I'm going to go straight into it. In the aftermath of COP27, what was achieved and what stood out for you?
Yeah, thank you very much, Jean, for that very important question for the outcomes of COP27 that we had in Sharm el-Sheikh this particular year. Some of the key things that Africa has been pushing for a while, for example, is the establishment of the fund on loss and damage. That was our biggest achievement. And the COP27 actually was viewed as an implementation COP because we are coming from the Glasgow COP26. We are the Glasgow backed. And the whole idea was that COP27 should be ensure that the issues raised during COP26 are on implementation first. So we were happy to find that the establishment of the Loss and Damage Fund was one of the very important things that are there. There are also other key milestones that were marked up, actually, where are in line that various decisions on various articles of negotiations were actually agreed on. For example, we moving towards ensuring that we go to procedures and modalities on implementation of the cooperative approaches that are negotiated in the Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. So that I can see is one of the very good kind of things that came out from this discussion there. The other area that I can mention that really also stood out is this commitment that we are still getting in terms of climate financing. It's really critical that the private sector are being pushed in a way that they can be able to put resources to ensure that they support the vulnerable countries and the least developed countries in a way to respond to the impacts of climate change. So the climate financing issue, again, to me, came out very well in this case there. Then the capacity issues that are being addressed in different sectors that are actually basically vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, again, were well highlighted. And they came in a way that they can respond to the needs of the people. So I can mention those are a few of them for now.
Thank you for that. Now that you've brought us to COP27, and I feel like COP27 was the time that we were thinking about carbon trading, I'm going to move us into that. And I want us to talk about an initiative. I think, Stella, you know this initiative that came out from COP27 that was related to carbon trading. COP27 served as a business fair for entrepreneurs, for countries, and wishing to benefit from new carbon markets. So let's get into first, what is carbon trading, before we go into what happened in COP27 with regard to carbon trading?
Thank you, Chen, again. When we talk about carbon trading, what exactly do we mean by that? Maybe just to give you a little bit of understanding about that is that in view of addressing the challenges of the temperature rise, which you can term as the global warming, the parties have come together in a way that identifies or incentivizes ways to actually reduce these emissions because they significantly contribute to the global warming, temperature rise. And these emissions are driven mainly from the human activities, which we call anthropogenic activities. So in that regard, you say, how can we find ways that can be able to ensure that those entities that are actually doing more emissions are incentivized in a way that they can be able to minimize them? And therefore, one of the instruments that the parties have been negotiating for some time now is to establish that kind of a mechanism that they can be able to actually trade those emission reductions, their efforts have made, as an incentive to really reduce them. So as a result, for example, the Kyoto Protocol, when it came to place, we established one of the framework to ensure that developed countries that have been identified to basically be top in the emissions, they have their own caps. So therefore, that framework is where they say we have to offset these emissions. And how do we do it? We have to find ways on embarking on projects and programs in areas that we believe are more vulnerable to the impact of climate change, and then provide resources to really enable them progress in the situation there. And that basically formed the basis of establishing a market. And that market in the Kyoto Protocol is what we call the compliance market under the Clean Development Mechanism. So that market was set basically to offer an avenue under which an investor or a country can basically trade the buying and selling of the carbon emission reductions, which in this case are basically valued under what called certified emission reduction. So they follow clear procedures, they follow clear standards under which you can be certified that your efforts you've made has been able to reduce this amount of emissions, which are given tons. For example, if you have a land sector by hectare, in that case there. So you trade those emissions because they're certified. You're given certificates of the emission. You are, for example, generating 1 million emission certificates is what you put there in the registry and the trade. So there we can basically specify that trading is buying and the selling of the emission reductions from the projects or activity they're trying to put in place to reduce those emissions.
The currency that we use, if I can call it that, quote unquote, currency that we use to trade is carbon credits.
Yeah, great. So the effort you actually put to reduce 1 ton of a carbon dioxide equivalent, you get the credit.
So 1 ton, let me just simplify this for our audience.
Yeah.
1 ton of carbon dioxide equals 1 carbon credit.
Absolutely.
So now, as you said earlier, you have a project that emits a certain amount of carbon. You calculate how much, or you estimate how much worth of carbon that is. Then you're able to convert that into carbon credits that you can then now use to trade in the carbon market.
Yeah, absolutely correct. Yep.
Let me come in with a follow-up question to that.
Thank you,
Dr. Weber, for that good answer. So now, is this happening in Kenya? Are we carbon trading as a country? Do we have carbon credits? And I know as a country, we have our national determined NDC contribution. Are we meeting that through carbon trading? Please speak to that.
Okay. Thank you again, Stella, for that very exciting question once more in view of whether Kenya, are we doing carbon trading or not? As a country, yes, we are doing it. And I want to take the memory lane from the when Kyoto Protocol came in place. And in the context of the Kyoto Protocol, the whole idea that African countries were basically used to assist in offsetting the emissions. And now the Kyoto Protocol, what was the architecture of the Kyoto Protocol? It was binary in a way, where we had developed countries called as Annex One countries and developing countries as Annex Two countries. So Annex One countries were identified with the top emitters in the world. And therefore, they are the responsibility to contribute to the global warming we have. So their actions, in a way, impact quite significantly to the countries that are developing on the context that most of the emission sources were from industrial development of these countries. So their contribution comes to budget, what called the carbon budget balance that are given, they have found they're doing more. So they are quickly reaching their caps in this case. And therefore, what they need was to be given through the Kyoto Protocol an opportunity to invest in the developing world, what they call carbon offset projects. For example, in the forest sector, they were able to establish through the Clean Development Mechanism, what they call afforestation and reforestation programs, in a way to get those emissions reduced. And therefore, during their reporting, they can indicate that we have made this much efforts and therefore we can continue with our industrial activities. But as it is, not every party will be able to go wide investment. Private entrepreneurship comes on board, and what they do is basically to proceed and generate projects, either in afforestation or reforestation, or in transport sector or the energy sector. And these companies, they are not obliged to, say, reduce your emissions. So they do as a business, and they invest in these projects and in their package of activities, they're able to quantify the emissions reduced as a result of their interventions. It can be either afforestation or reforestation. So they can take this into a market, what we call the compliance market, and they can trade. So as a result, Kenya, during the Kyoto Protocol, did gain more specifically from the energy sector. Investors are there, and we have volumes of those certified emission reduction from the energy sector.
Which in fact, I think Kengen, we were researching this, and we found that Kengen has their approval. They've received approval to sell about 4.6 million tons of carbon emission reductions under the UNFCCC framework.
That's exactly. That's what it means. So Kenya is there with that case. Since we are part of the Kyoto Protocol, we are able to benefit the what's come from that protocol that Kenya was part of. So investors come in and do that. Kenyan, as you mentioned, have been one of the biggest beneficiaries for that case there.
And
so,
how do they trade it?
As I've said again, the trading mechanism is there's a registry, if I may just go to that. It's a registry that once you develop a project, and this project, you quantify the emissions you've been able to generate, you deposit them in the called Clean Development Mechanism Registry. That registry has a control. There's a Clean Development Mechanism Board, which actually looks at the compliance and all issues there and say, this amount of emissions come from company A, come from Kenya, and that registry. And therefore, their interest is raised. Buyers can come from private sector, can come from the government, can come from anybody who has a responsibility to reduce emissions. So it's the way like you're doing, the way you like do like the stock exchange. You want to press your shares, I want to have them there. So they buy those certificates that this effort has been registered, has been validated, has been verified to be that truly it has reduced emissions. And therefore, they take it and they continue building up in their portfolio of investments. So that you find the trading takes place in a way. It's not like you're carrying something like in a bag and on your take the market. No, it is clearly as a registry under which you have a plus and a minus of your quantities that you have been able to reduce in this case. So if I may come into a concern again to the latest one, because you must make a difference between the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement, it when we continue the trajectory of the emissions and the global warming, it was evident that it's not only the responsibility of the Annex One countries, it became the responsibility of all of us.
Yeah.
So whether Annex One or Annex One countries, there was a responsibility. So the Paris Agreement, therefore, brought in what you call common but differentiated responsibilities. So we have our common responsibility, but we have a different in our contribution on what we do in terms of global warming. So the generation or the introduction of nationally determined contributions came in. What that means, each party has taken into account how does it contribute to the emissions? How does it adapt to the impacts of climate change? So countries from 2015, 2016 were able to actually obliged to have a clear identification of their emission sources. Like from in Kenya, transport sector is one of it. Energy sector is one of it. Waste management is one of it. Agriculture is another one. Forest another one. So we have like five or six major sources of emissions. So we have projected that, for example, by 2030, our revised ambitious national determined contribution to have reduced this emission by this much. Forest sector, for instance, by 2030, you're supposed to reduce about 20.1 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. When you come to the energy sector, it's supposed to reduce about 48 point something million of carbon emissions of this case there. So that means we have a responsibility to basically reduce this emission from each sector. Aggregate is about less than 1 million, I think around there. I mean, it'll be quite specific, but they are still provided. So that means when you look at our national damage contributions, we said, yes, what is our capacity to actually reduce these emissions? We said the implementation of our nationally determined contributions is conditional on financing. And we are able to meet about 13% of our obligations. 87% is basically conditional in financing. And therefore, we do see that if we go to the new regime, which we've raised, Jean, under the COP decisions that we'll be negotiating on, common cooperative approaches in carbon trading and the common market approaches, transiting from the Clean Development Mechanism to the Paris Agreement Mechanism, then we stand therefore to gain once more in that case there, because our nationally determined contributions are conditional on the availability of funds. And therefore, the carbon market and trading becomes an opportunity under which the country can be able to sell as a supplier of those carbon emissions and therefore use the resources to actually respond to the sustainable development goals and the other socioeconomic demands that the country has provided. So that comes in that direction. So the answer is yes, through the NDCs, we are more likely to find an opportunity to actually account. For example, as I've mentioned, if a certain sector has been given a certain amount of those emissions there, we cannot say, we don't have the capacity to do this. Chinese company comes in, invests in this particular sector, quantifies the emissions. If we are able to meet our commitment that we have signed there, any amount Chinese generates can be able to trade out there. And therefore, that gives us an opportunity in such a circumstance. So you can find actually does that kind of a very good engagement. But maybe because we are in the context of COP27, allow me to indicate what is it that we have been discussing there very strongly in the Article 6.2 of the Paris Agreement, which basically talks about the cooperative approaches. The cooperative approaches where two parties agree, and I want to re-emphasize the concept of nationally determined contributions. So if I'm using an example, Jean is here, Stella is here. You have your commitment, here's our commitment. If you see projects that her level of development requires or will meet more of these emissions, it's possible to come to Jean, and then Jean is able to offset some of it to Stella. So what I mean is that parties can cooperate and say, through your actions, through your investment, you can be able to actually, I can buy your efforts you've made to reduce emissions, provided they're above your national contributions. So in such a circumstance, we refined the internationally transferred mitigation outcomes, the ITMOS, that Article 6.2 tries to leverage so as parties can come together and they have their responsibilities in a way that I can buy from you. So what does it mean? You can choose if the whatever you have is above your commitment, then you can account it in part A. But Chin cannot account because it can bring what you call the corresponding adjustment. You have to reduce what you've been able to raise and then the other one top it up. So that provides that framework under the 6.2 article for committing our nationally and determined contributions.
You've brought in something that I want to discuss. We can come to an agreement and your activities that are harming the environment can be offset by my activities that are helping the environment. Now, how do we ensure that we report correctly and we don't greenwash? Because now that this feels like it's very paper-based and it's negotiated in a place that's far away from what is actually happening on the ground, how do we ensure that we're not greenwashing things and under-reporting and we are actually aiding the environment rather than creating a balance sheet that has profit and loss and making the math work in a faraway space?
Thank you very much, Jean, again, for that very good question. In the all of this process of carbon trading, what is being really pushed for is transparency. It's quite key in that whatever you do, you must be as open as possible. So during the negotiations, what you're struggling for is to find mechanisms, procedures, modalities under which you can participate in your trading. So when you tell me you have reduced 1 million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent from your activity, the methodologies that are being used, the standards that are being used are common and understandable to everybody. And therefore, in that global level, a registry is being developed, a database is being developed, such that your project activity as a unique identifier for tracking and a procedures guide that you declare what you've been able to generate and what been able to sell. So the bigger argument is that there must be a corresponding adjustment on what you are doing. As you have mentioned, if you put money in a bank, you have 1 million, you want to withdraw 200,000, truly the balance will be 800,000. So that must be as simple as it is, whether in America, whether in wherever you are, in each country, you are working with your card, ATM card. You cannot say, you know, you are in the US now, you are the 1 million in Kenya. When you want to withdraw your dollars, then it makes much more. No, that's a kind of a transparency that's being fought for, so that these projects have unique identifier. There's a database for them, and there's actually a compliance committee that's being set under the Bari Agreement to ensure that all these activities really get to what ought to be. And that therefore brings the concern about the greenwashing that has been mentioned in many dimensions. Why is that coming a big concern? To me, it's because you can form a company and say, I'm green, I'm carbon neutral. That means I'm able to account my carbon footprints. I am compliant of this. You put an artifact that you are more compliant, but in reality, you are not. So that counts to greenwashing, that you continue doing more activities, you're not conscious on emission, you're releasing that more to the atmosphere, the environment. So mentioning that you are compliant when you are not, it is actually what called environmental corruption, where I'm going to use kind of a terminology. You miss the integrity of the environment. So that aspect therefore being looked at, how can we verify your actions that indeed you have reduced, you are really conscious on your actions, and you remain the truth that you are reducing the emissions from what you do. And some of the discussion we have is that we should have mechanisms to verify on what you're mentioning. If I want to certify you that you are carbon neutral, there are various things that have to be checked in and ensure that indeed when I declare company A is green, it's really green. It should not be the other way around.
And I like that you're saying that, because I feel like now that we're getting into carbon markets and carbon trading more, there has to be a mechanism that ensures that there's no one double counting. So even before we get into green corruption, let's just talk about double counting, where sometimes multiple people are claiming that they are reducing their emissions using the same projects. So just to ensure that with a unique identifier, you can be able to assign one particular project to one particular reduction. Then that and allows us to be able to actually track what is happening. Then again, the honesty and the transparency of just making sure that what you are emitting and what you are reducing are tallied, and that you're not, as you're saying, greenwashing, just declaring that you have a greater impact than you actually do. Yeah, so I think that would be very, very important.
If I may come in with a follow-up question, at COP27, the African Carbon Market Initiative was launched. Speak more about this and how Kenya as a country will benefit from this initiative.
Yeah, I think this is a good kind of point you've raised. And the concern the African continent has been having is, how can we establish a market for our own? Because the carbon market is well established in Europe, is established in the US, but in Africa, we have not made strides to have this. And yet the investment of these carbon offset emissions are taking place in Africa and the developing world. So if that's the case, that it gives us an opportunity to look what opportunity we have as Africa, what funding mechanism can come on board. And therefore, the launch of the African the carbon offset initiatives for that was basically to create this awareness that we have the potential to also invest in this particular enterprise. It's an opportunity that's coming in. Why can't we harness all the efforts we have so we can be able to have a trading within our systems? Like, for example, under the framework for aviation industry, there is a lot of emissions. Our flights can connect to Netherlands, can connect to Europe, can connect there as well. So you have those opportunities that you're also making efforts in a way that we should incentivize this new venture of carbon trading. So the whole gist of it was basically to bring up the necessity of Africa, like in the case of the European Union trading on carbon, that also can have a similar infrastructure setup in the continent. So as wherever you have things beyond your obligations, you can always wish to get from country A and continue in the business, because Africa is so developing. People are mining coal, people are doing a lot of oil exploration. You are familiar with all these things there. And all those are basically moving towards emissions, the atmosphere, and the eventual contribute to global warming. If you have efforts at the continental level and able to have a better framework, why not? And then it can also bring a new setup on how the financing mechanism can come in, the investment, green investment coming on board. So to me, when the head of states who are launching this, I happen to be part of the Africa team, actually, we are feeling comfortable that this is some good discourse toward the direction. We're looking forward one time that we have a good market for Africa and for Africans, where we can negotiate prices, where we can lock it. Because let me shock you a little bit that their market of carbon, for example, in Europe, all the use cannot penetrate. We've been following this trade, these discussions for a while. When Kyoto Protocol was coming to an end, projected to come to an end, the amount of dollars that one ton of certified emission reduction was coming to was come less than $1. When it began, maybe from 20, 10, 5, when front of the market came on board, it came like a rebrief because people have invested and you are going to invest less than $1. Honestly, what is that? Then people are saying there's no value of my investment. So the fund was coming in $3, $5, $7. So people were able to even switch, even they want to negotiate with the Clean Development Mechanism Board to actually shift their certified emission reduction into very voluntary or verified emission reduction. So that's the kind of a quagmire people were in. But in the market where economic trade, one ton can even about $300 per ton of carbon dioxide equivalent, or over 200, which you cannot be able to trade because it's like a boundary. You are not allowed to have that. It's internal market. It's not external market. So I see that this African initiative on carbon markets will be able to cure some of those things there and get value of the investment. So an investor can come into Africa and say, I want to go into carbon markets and then develop those emission reductions and trade in a market that is suitable and comfortable for them. So these are some of the issues that personally I'm seeing that have a meaning and value to what we are pushing for in this aspect of addressing the climate change in the country.
Carbon trading is the issue we are discussing today in our episode, and we want to discuss what types of regulations are there in place to regulate carbon trading in Kenya, and which are those. So what regulations do we have regulating carbon trading in Kenya?
Thank you for that. We have several regulations that regulate finance, climate, carbon trading, climate change, starting with the Climate Change Act, and then the Water Act, the Energy Act, and EMCA. EMCA is the Environment Management and Coordination Act. So going back to the Climate Change Act provides for climate finance. And when it talks about climate finance, it says climate finance is a process of mobilizing funds or monies from government, non-government entities, private entities to finance climate change mitigation and adaptation. The Act further mandates the Cabinet Secretary, National Treasury, to come up with regulations setting out the procedure and powers of climate finance. So those regulations are not yet in place. So we definitely do need those regulations as a country. Moving on to the Water Act. The Water Act establishes the water sector trust fund established under that particular act. The functions of that trust fund, the trust fund, of course, is run by a board of trustees. So the functions, one of the key functions of that board of trustees of the water sector trust fund is to develop incentive programs for water resources management, including climate change adaptation and mitigation. So that is a mandate of that particular fund, which is an ongoing mandate just to come up with those measures. Then we move on to the Energy Act. The Energy Act has two sections, sections 44 and section 75. Section 44 is read together with section 43, which establishes the Rural Electrification and Renewable Energy Corporation. One of the key mandates of that corporation is to oversee implementation of rural electrification program throughout the country. And of course, further on is to harness opportunities under the Clean Development Mechanism and carbon credit trading in promoting the exploitation of renewable resources. So that's a very key obligation of that particular corporation. Section 75 of the Act sets out the similar requirements, but now for the Cabinet Secretary in charge of energy. And that is the CS is to harness opportunities for Clean Development Mechanism and the carbon credit trading to exploit this for purpose of renewable energy sources. So that's what the Energy Act provides. Then the key among all these acts to me will be the EMCA, that is the Environment Management and Coordination Act. Section 56A, which is an amendment to the Act provides or mandates the Cabinet Secretary in charge of environment to come up with guidelines, of course, with consulting lead agencies in this space, to come up with guidelines and prescribe measures for climate change. Those guidelines are not yet in place. But that notwithstanding, a key international document that guides us or law is the UNFCC, United Nations Framework Climate Convention on Climate Change. So this convention is a fairly old one and has over time had protocols passed to further run or manage this particular convention. So one of these is the Kyoto Protocol. So the Kyoto Protocol mandates all the state countries to have a DNA, that is a designated national authority. At the designated national authority, the key role is to ensure or to set the parameters or goals of establishing clean development mechanism projects. So the DNA is guided by the sustainable goals of a country. With those goals in mind, then projects that are brought before the DNA are approved as clean development mechanism projects. So back home in Kenya, the DNA for Kenya, the designated national authority for Kenya is NEMA. NEMA is a body that is mandated to implement EMCA, the Environment Management and Coordination Act. So now NEMA has been able to certify certain projects as clean development mechanism projects. Key among them is about six projects managed by KenGen. They have been certified as clean development mechanism projects. But then even with the DNA certifying them, there's a notch higher of certification and verification, which is done by the UNFCCC CDM Executive Board. So the UNFCCC CDM Executive Board validates and verifies CDM projects that have been certified by the national designated national authority as projects that have passed as CDM projects. Then it goes ahead to issue CERs or carbon credits. So CERs are certified emission reductions. So for each one CER given to a project, that is equivalent to 1 ton of carbon dioxide removed from the atmosphere. So that's how Kenya is participating in this space of carbon trading.
So Stella, you spoke about regulations, and I feel like in the legal space, the law is always playing catch up to the innovations in practice. So what would those regulations cover, especially with regard to carbon trading?
Yes, indeed, it is true that law catches up to practice. Now, of course, carbon trading has been happening in many jurisdictions, either under compliance or voluntary market. I would recommend that, one, we have regulations in this particular country, specifically speaking to carbon trading. I would recommend also that we consider having regulations for a voluntary kind of a market where we provide the floor as opposed to the ceiling in terms of price. So that when you have accumulated CERs, credit emission reduction units that have been certified, then you at least know that the bare minimum is this. So that then when you are having that bargaining back and forth, you know that it can't fall below a particular figure, at least as guided by the regulations. I believe that brings clarity. It incentivizes the individuals or the projects that will want to go into that particular platform. It also reduces exploitation where there is no flaw as to what you can charge for these CERs that have taken quite a lot of work to just accumulate them. The other thing I would recommend that should go into the regulations and that will work as an incentive for even trading is tax incentives. So that we then know that if you have accumulated these CERs, because CERs should be some form of asset. It may be a floating asset of some sort. So that asset, number one, you should be able even to trade it, even for financing in a financial institution. Because when they know that the bare minimum that one CER is, say, $5 or $10, then they know how to ascertain the value of that asset for purpose of financing. Number two, the tax incentive that comes with that, then incentivizes CDM certified projects to go into that market, to know that if we are then able to sell these CERs, this much will come back in the form of savings because of tax incentives. So that broadens the market. It makes it thrive and grow. And there is exchange of money. So there's movement of money in the economy. Those are the three things that I think are key to have in that regulation, amongst other things as well.
So a price floor that we are able to at least have some sort of certainty when we walk into the market that, you know, at the very minimum, if I'm to trade it just at the floor that has been set by the regulation, this is how much I can get. And that also allows you to be able to trade because it's an asset. Now that you know how much this asset is worth in a fixed amount, you can now go back with this asset and ask for other sorts of financing. Then finally, it also incentivizes you to be able to register into the market so that you know that once I have, because CERs, accumulation of them, as you've said rightly, is a long term goal. It's really, you do not just wake up and create a project that then now accumulates enough CERs. It takes quite a while. So it will incentivize institutions to, first of all, take on projects that will be able to give them CERs in the future, and then be able to take those CERs and trade with them. You spoke about two things. You spoke about compliance and voluntary markets, and you spoke about how we need these regulations, especially in the context of a voluntary market. What types of market work best for us in the global south?
Yes, for the developing countries, I believe the best market will be a voluntary market working towards a compliance market. The end goal should always be a compliance market, but the starting place for developing countries, in my opinion, will be best at voluntary countries for the following reasons. Developing countries are the least emitters, yet the ones who suffer the most from the effects of greenhouse gases. Developing countries need to catch up to be developed countries at some point. To move from a developing to a developed country means that then industrialization has to come in. With industrialization, there is emission. Of course, the target is to move to clean energy, but clean energy may not always be sufficient or may not always be enough to get to that point of development. So because of that, a compliance market will be a tightrope for these developing countries that are the least emitters. But that notwithstanding, they still need to be aware that climate change is impacting them and impacting them negatively. And they also need to contribute in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and participate in that process. So for that to happen and happen effectively, voluntary markets are best. But voluntary markets needs to be niched with some form of regulation, so that then they are incentivized. These industrialized, these companies that are coming into these developing countries, even the companies that the developing countries are forming themselves, they have that idea that we need to reduce on greenhouse gas emissions. These are the benefits. We are able to accumulate CERs. We are able to sell them at the bare minimum of this much. So that way, we indeed ensure that there's a very good mix of aspiration to development while reducing greenhouse gases.
You spoke about something earlier about the nationally determined contributions, the NDCs, and the relationship between NDCs, climate change, and the protocol, the Kyoto Protocol. Can you tell us a little bit about the voluntary nature of our, for instance, NDC in Kenya, how we determine it, and the difference between developed countries and how they as the greatest emitters and as industrialized nations that have contributed significantly to climate change are then mandated to make certain contributions. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you for that question. So under the Kyoto Protocol, each signatory country, Kenya being one of them, has to remit their national determined contribution rate. For developing countries, you're supposed, as you're remitting your NDC, National Determined Contribution, you're supposed to say how that is going to be financed. So for developed countries, that's where they have the compliance market to ensure that they meet that target of their NDC. But for us, we are allowed some leeway to call for funding to reach our NDCs. So for Kenya, our target is about 32%. We committed to, I think, about 8% to fund that, but the bigger chunk is to be funded by funding. So you see, if the only way to meet our NDC will be through funding, you can imagine how carbon trading can be an effective way of accumulating these funds so that we are then incentivized. Number one, the carbon trading will help us achieve the 8% that we've set for ourselves, that particular percentage that we've set for ourselves that will not be funded. Then hopefully get the funding for the remaining amount to reach our NDCs. But then how do we then show that we have put in this much money into our NDC if our voluntary market is not regulated? if it's a hazard. So regulation brings clarity. It shows how we have reduced our carbon footprint and by how much. So that way we are then accountable to the party of states as to how we have worked towards our NDC. Remember, this NDC also forms part of our Vision 2030 for this country. So for sure, as much as we will want to see greenhouse gases reduced across the globe, it has to start home and start home very deliberate with deliberate steps.
Thank you for that. And I think the take home from the legal aspects of carbon trading is regulation. We need regulation, first of all, under the Climate Change Act, regulated by the CES National Treasury, to come up with regulations on how to fundraise. If the significant part of our NDC contribution will be funded, then we need regulations on how that financing will be sourced, how that financing will be managed, how that financing will be accounted for. We also need regulations to regulate our voluntary carbon trading market. If we will be able to use it to be able to contribute to our NDC, then we have to have some sort of floor that we know when once we bring our CERs to this market, this is how much they are worth, this is how much we can trade them for, this is how much we can negotiate with them in the large compliance markets. Thank you for that, Stella. That brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Vincent Onguso Oeba. And I'd like also to thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us, to educate us on carbon trading, on carbon markets, and even on the challenges that we will face going forward and what we need to do to solve them. I also like to thank my co-host, Stella Ojango. Thank you so much for coming and sitting in with us and for also contributing to this very important topic. I am your host, Jean Kambuni, and we hope you enjoyed this episode. Tell us what you think about it in the comment section of our social media pages or on email. Our email address is info@gvalawfirm.com. You can also follow Gikera and Badgama Advocates on social media. Find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook as GVA Law Firm. Thank you for joining us on the GVA Legal Podcast. Let's get